Where have we been thus far, for those who might be joining us for the first time? Last night, sort of an introductory lesson, we talked about stumbling blocks or stepping stones. It's your choice. Rocks or problems or adversity will find your life in various ways and various times. And it's your choice whether you will trip over them and cause damage to your faith and your walk with the Lord, or you can step up on those stones and grow and mature. Of course, we want to choose the latter, but it's not always that easy. And then we've been looking today thus far at some Bible characters, some ones we're acquainted with, but trying to glean some more lessons. We looked at Job in depth, we looked at Abraham in depth, and we'll split some time in this session between Joseph and also the Apostle Peter. So let's start in the Old Testament. Let's start with Joseph. If you want to open up to Genesis 37, we'll kind of hit some highlights, and I also had access to some artwork here we'll share momentarily, trying to go through his story through the last one-fourth of Genesis. So here's the main takeaway I want you to try to grasp for Joseph. You may need to trust God even when he allows others to inflict great pain in your life. Probably if you've lived long enough, you have had occasions where people have inflicted pain in your life. Even then, we have a choice, right? How will we respond? Will we respond with kindness, compassion, faithfulness to the Lord? Or will we grow bitter? Will we retaliate? Will we seek vengeance? Will we stoop to maybe what we might say more baser instincts that we see modeled every day in the world, which God does not want us to pattern ourselves after? So let's just jump right in. Genesis 37. I know a little bit about life in our big family, and I can only imagine what it would be like to have 11 sons and no tempering influence of girls around. It's good to have girls, right? Renee and I had 5 boys. We just figured, okay, girls were never in the equation. And then we were blessed to have girls and 3 girls to round out our family. But in this case here in the text, Jacob, with his multiple wives and concubines, ends up with Joseph as an 11th son. But this is a special son because it's from the special mother, right? And he's favored. And nowhere in Scripture do you see that I'm aware of any benefits from either polygamy or, you know, multiple families all kind of being blended here, if you will, through polygamy. You never see good in David's family, in Solomon. You don't see it here either. There's always problems. And so it is here, because as soon as Joseph's of some age, he's being blessed with special privileges. And don't you just know the 10 older brothers, they love this. Now, they're not really that much older than him. If you really study the chronology, all these sons are born, in Jacob's 80s, more or less, and into his 90s, if I'm doing the math right. But anyway, Jacob didn't even move out of his parents' house till he was in his 70s. So if mom and dad are trying to push you out, you know, kidding. Anyway. So he gets this special coat of many colors. Now he starts having dreams. And we learn later he's not only able to have dreams like this, he's able to interpret dreams, a gift that God had given him. Anyway, he talks. We can read a little bit of this. Look in verse 5 there of chapter 37. Joseph had a dream that he told it to his brothers. They hated him even more. More attention to Joseph. So they're envious of him. We understand that. He said, "Please hear this dream. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Behold, my sheaf arose, also stood upright. Indeed, your sheaf stood all around, and they bowed down to my sheaf." What are you saying, Joseph? You're the baby of the family. We're gonna pay honor, and you're going to have dominion over us? What are you talking about? They hated him. And he had another dream yet. Of what? Well, we've got the heavenly bodies here, the sun, the moon, 11 stars. It says 11, you know, was this complete you know, prediction, or was, you know, Rachel already pregnant with Benjamin? I'm not really sure on that. But anyway, this dream gets told to the father as well, and of course the stars are bowing down to him. It's interesting. If you trace through these chapters, there's no, to my mind, there's no explicit point where Joseph, there's any recorded sin that Joseph committed. But this might be the closest thing to it. Well, there's nothing wrong with him telling the dreams, but in a practical sense, his brothers already hate him. Can he just not help himself? I mean, at some point, you know, may Joseph, maybe you just keep that one to yourself. Keep that one in your house. He does. She's sharing it. And, you know, maybe the Lord wanted these things known so they could piece this all together 20-some years later, right? Well, you know what happens after this. We've got Dad hearing this and Dad sort of thinking it over and reflecting upon it. But it does trouble him to some extent. And the older brothers are out tending to the flock. So why isn't Joseph out there? Well, because he's the special son. He's going to be an administrator, so to speak. He's going to be the one checking up on him. So, Dad, hey, go check up on your big brothers. Does this not just sound like a bad idea? It's just, I guess Jacob could not see what was going to happen here. So Joseph's out searching, and he has a little trouble finding him, but he gets some direction there in 15 through 17. And then here he comes. Genesis 37, 18. The brothers saw him afar off. Even before he came near them, they conspired against him. What kept them in line before? Dad. Dad was around. You know, there's a lesson there, right? God designed families to have a mom and a dad. Sometimes some problems are avoided when dads are around like they need to be. But on this occasion, Dad is nowhere to be seen. And it's time, in the brothers, older brothers' minds, it's time to take things into their own hands. So here comes the dreamer. Let's kill him. Let's see how the dreams turn out then. So what are they going to do? They're plotting against him. They are going to throw him into a pit, into a well. There's no water in it. Of course, we learn here when we're reading that Reuben, of course, Reuben's the firstborn, that Reuben intends to try to save his life. So on one hand, you might say, well, oh, good for Reuben. Well, you know, he's going to try to outsmart him here, right? But trying to meet evil with craftiness, that's not necessarily a formula for success. You know, he should have taken a stand right then. Brothers, this is wrong. I know we hate Joseph, but we can't be killing our brother. It would be a sin against him and against God. That's what should have happened right here, but it didn't. We could spend time to look at the idea of peer pressure, family dynamics. Everybody's wanting to do something. So what? Is it the right thing to do? If it's not the right thing to do, friends, stand up, take a stand for what's right. So they throw their 17-year-old brother into the pit. And they decide not to kill him as you read through this chapter here. I mean, what real profit is there if we kill him? We can sell him and make some money out of the deal. And then we're not guilty of his bloodshed, at least not directly. So they're having a feast. Joseph down in the pit. Can you imagine Joseph's anguish? And trying to encourage us to put ourselves into the position of Job or Abraham, and on this occasion, Joseph. Okay, so Dad loves you because he loves your mom better than the other women in the family. You've been favored, you've been given responsibility, you've really done nothing wrong, but now you're in this pit, and your life is in great danger. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Well, we're going to see Joseph is going to trust God. That's going to be his choice through, seems like, every stage of his ups and downs in his existence. So they find some Midianite traders, Mishmaelites, and they are going to sell him. As far as they're concerned, problem solved. Oh, but we still got to figure out something to tell Dad. So they have taken the special coat, and they tried to prepare it in such a way where it looked like some wild animal had slaughtered their brother. Okay? And, you know, this just breaks Jacob's heart. It breaks his heart. And you see on many occasions in the in this end of Genesis. So you see it in verse 35. The sons arose to try to comfort him. He refused it. I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. You know, well, his emotions were wrong. There's one lesson you can extract from there. He was as convinced as he could be. His boy had been slaughtered. He'd been deceived. He'll learn the truth in about 20 years. But for those 20 years, what do you think he's thinking about regularly? Oh, my son, why did I send you on that errand? He is harboring all kinds of, no doubt, guilty emotions. When in fact, the brothers, the older brothers, are the guilty ones. And they're thinking about it too. I think it's the case whenever some bad things start coming their way. What's the first thing out of their mouth? Do you remember? Oh, this is because of what we did. It was 20 years earlier. So I don't have any doubts. Anytime something unfortunate came into the brothers' lives, they're immediately thinking back to, you know, this is, we're just getting what we deserve for what we did. So they had a guilty conscience. So we'll give them credit for that at least. They are not so calloused in their realization. They did wrong. They know they did wrong. But big picture, we know where this is going. Joseph is suffering. God's going to turn this into a tremendous blessing. So what happens next with Joseph? Well, it doesn't pertain to our account, so we'll skip over Judah and Tamar. You get into chapter 39 here. And Joseph, of course, he ends up sold into Potiphar's house. Well, this is fascinating. Potiphar, you know, captain of the guard, chief of the executioner, some would say. And Joseph immediately does what? Well, he doesn't pout and say, woe is me, I'm sold as a slave, my family hates me. How come dad's not coming to rescue me? I mean, maybe he thought some of those things. But he did not let it slow him down. He is going to make the best of whatever circumstance he finds himself in. He's a slave. So he's going to be the best slave he can be. And I don't mean to be cute, but where you find yourself, if you are a garbage truck driver, be the best garbage truck driver you can be. If you're an attorney, be the best attorney you can be. If you are, no matter what you're doing, where you're at, you be the best you can be. Joseph, this was out of his control. He could choose to do what at this point? Rebel? Be beaten? Be killed? Or he could suck it up and be the best servant possible. And that's what he did. But the Lord was with him. Remember? Just like Job, he thought, where's God? Why is this happening? This isn't fair. God was aware of Job's plight. God was aware of Joseph's situation. And God sees us too, friends. When you're hurting so badly, God sees that. Trust Him. Stick with Him. There's a plan, even if we can't discern it. So Joseph's going to be trained in Egyptian life here. He's going to become a great business administrator. And even here, he has problems. Because apparently he's good looking. And so Potiphar's wife, she's after. And Joseph pretty much tells him, look, everything in Potiphar's house is under my administration here. You're the only thing that's off limits to me here. I'm in charge. He doesn't even know what's going on, but I cannot have intimate relations with you. That'd be a sin against God. It would be wrong for me to do that. So Potiphar has absolute trust in him, and she has her mind made up. And there's an occasion when they're alone and she ends up grabbing his garment and he's trying to run away. And Potiphar comes home. And an interesting thing I read, and I can't guarantee this is exactly right, but it does make sense. If Potiphar really is the chief of the executioners, if that's his role, if he really believed that his wife was sexually assaulted by their slave, do you think Joseph's really going to end up in prison? I don't think so. I think he's angry because he realizes his wife, he's going to have to heed what she said, but he's going to lose the best servant he's ever had over this thing. That's my opinion, and I'll label it as my opinion. I don't think he believed Joseph was guilty of this, but now what? At age 17, he ends up as a slave. We don't know how long he was in Potiphar's house. But between his time being a slave and now he's going to end up in prison, he doesn't get out of prison until he's 30. 17 to 30. Some would say the prime of your life. He's a slave and a prisoner. Now, I know if you're 50, that's the prime, right? Or if you're 40. But you know, his later teenage years, all through his 20s. And for what? What had he done to deserve being a slave or being imprisoned? Not a single thing. Is that the kind of thing, if you lose 13 years of your life, you think that might make us bitter? Yeah, lesser people would become bitter, would lose their faith in God. Friends, these examples we've been looking at, I know these are extreme cases. Job's an extreme case. Abraham, sacrifice your son, that's an extreme case. Losing 13 years of your life, that's an extreme case. But if these men have that kind of faith in God, they're there in the text for our learning. We can develop that same level of trust. So no matter what block of adversity falls into our lap, we can handle it with the Lord's help and with the help of our Christian brothers and sisters. Again, you lose a job, you lose a loved one, you lose your health. I mean, these are things that we will deal with in various ways and at various times. We cannot allow them to derail our faith. That's not the point. They might be a test. They might be God trying to get our attention to correct us, trying to help perfect our faith. There's a number of reasons why it might happen. In Joseph's case, you get into chapter 40. We'll move a little quicker here, just for the sake of time. But in chapter 40, he's in prison. He's already setting himself apart in prison. He's got responsibility in prison because the Lord was with him. We could have a whole sermon on that phrase, right? Because the Lord was with him. Why was the Lord with him? Because he was with the Lord. The Lord was supporting him, even though, boy, if to an outsider, it sure didn't look like the Lord was with him. Why would the Lord let him be sold as a slave if he was with him? God had a plan. Why would the Lord allow him to end up in prison if the Lord was with him? Because the Lord had a plan. It just hadn't unfolded yet. God sees it. So into chapter 40, Joseph here chronologically is about age 28. And, you know, we got to look for the good in adversity. That's what Joseph is doing here. So he has an opportunity to, skip the slide here, these dreams. Two other people end up in prison there temporarily here. We've got the butler and the baker all through chapter 40. And they had somehow offended Pharaoh and they end up in prison for a while. And they have these dreams. And rather than being bogged down in the details, here's the big picture. They have these dreams. They tell them to Joseph. Joseph explains exactly what's going to happen. One would be restored. One would be killed. Exactly the way it happens. You get to the end of chapter 40, though. What did Joseph told them to do? Hey, whenever you get back, hey, remember me. Remember me. And how does the chapter end? Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. He forgot him. 2 years later, all the while, Joseph's finishing out his 20s in prison. 2 years later, Joseph is age 30. God sends some dreams to the ruler of the land, to Pharaoh. And these dreams had Pharaoh really confused. You've got these really fat, healthy-looking cows being eaten up by these skinny, gaunt cows, and the skinny, gaunt cows are still skint and gaunt and ugly. And you got the same thing happening with really plump heads of grain being swallowed up by these sickly heads of grain. And Pharaoh's like, oh, I can't make sense of this. What does this mean? And then the butler remembers, I've been negligent, but now I remember, 2 years ago, there was this guy when I was in prison. He told me exactly the fulfillment of two different dreams, and they both came true. So they call for Joseph. So Joseph's fate is going to be just changed overnight, just like it was initially, right? He's dad's favorite. Everything's great. And then the next moment later, he's a slave. Now he's in prison. Later that day, he's before the ruler of the land. He tells the interpretation correctly. Hey, God has determined what's going to happen. And he's telling you, Pharaoh, there's going to be 7 great years of plenty. But you better be storing up everything you can during those years, because there's 7 years of famine that are going to come. And the 7 years of famine are going to be so rough, they're going to just kind of swallow up all that plenty. You're going to forget about the plenty pretty sure after that, pretty soon. So Pharaoh believed, and Pharaoh is so impressed by this that what does he say? He says, man, there's no one like you in whom the Spirit of God is. You understand all this? You're in charge of it, bud. So he gives Joseph the authority. He, you know, gives him his signet ring, puts fine garments on him, puts a gold chain around his neck. He rides around in the second chariot, and he gives him a wife. So, Joseph, wow. Is this a test? This is even part of the test, is it not? What could Joseph have done now? Fully adopted the Egyptian gods. He's arrived now, you know. He's in a very good position in every way. Storing up the grain. He and his wife have 2 sons. And now what? 7 years of plenty are over. The years of famine are upon them. And in short order, there are people from all over that region who hear that there's food to be purchased in Egypt. Everywhere else is run out, but this word even gets back to Jacob and his sons. And they say, hey, we need to go. I'm going to send you boys to Egypt. Go buy grain so we can survive this. And you know how the story goes. The brothers arrive, and there's opportunities for them to do what? Fulfill the dream. Bow down before their brother. And can't you just imagine the emotions of Joseph? Recognizing them. There's no chance they're recognizing him. He's speaking a different language. He's using an interpreter. He's no doubt dressed much differently than they'd ever seen him before. And he, you know, they have some interesting back and forth. He puts them in prison for a while, 3 days, and then they're allowed to go home. He secretly has their money put back in their bags, and then they go home to dad, and dad says, well, you need to go back. And there's this back and forth about Benjamin, because Joseph asked about if there was a younger brother. And eventually they go back, and this was really surprising to them. I'm summarizing briefly here. Whenever Joseph has a meal with these men, he seats them all in birth order, and he gives Benjamin 5 times the amount of food. Asa, how'd you like that? We go out to eat somewhere, and you get 5 times as much food as all your older brothers. That'd be all right? Yeah, that'd be all right. You know, was that a test? Why does Joseph do that? Is he wanting to see if, are these still jealous brothers? Maybe. Are they still full of hatred towards no doubt Benjamin was favored too, in it, maybe in a different way. But he's observing them, and then he's going to keep Benjamin, isn't he? Well, there's some discussion about that. And then Judah steps up in chapter 44, or they're going to leave rather. And, you know, again, there's something found. In this case, the silver cup. And Joseph's going to keep Benjamin, and Judah rises up as he should, and basically says, look, you know, keep me if needed. At this point, Joseph breaks down. He's going to have an emotional outburst, and he just can't keep it a secret anymore. When we get into chapter 45, he sends everyone away, and he's mourning. He's weeping aloud, Genesis 45:2. And then he asks his brothers, after he tells them, I'm Joseph. You just imagine their jaws dropping. Does my father still live? They are dismayed. No doubt. This is surprise coupled with absolute terror. Coupled with 20 years of guilty feeling, over 20 years at this point, at least 22 years. And then what? Well, that brings us to where I really want to make some applications. You know what happens next. He reveals himself. He sends them home with a bunch of supplies and carts. They're going to bring the father, Jacob, back. They're all going to move to Egypt. And by this point, Jacob is, I believe, 130 years old. It's a wonderful restoration. But these brothers, they continue to live in fear. They've done wrong, and I don't know if they can't forgive themselves. Even when dad dies, isn't it sad when you get to Genesis 50? Of course it's sad that dad dies, but so it goes with all of us. But once dad dies, the brothers, this is Genesis 50, verse 15. They said to themselves, perhaps Joseph will hate us and might actually repay us. How many years has it been now? Didn't Joseph die, or Jacob dies at what, 147? Am I remembering that right? So 17 years in the... I mean, this is something like 40 years after they had sold him. And they sent messengers and they lied to him. You know, dad said before he died to forgive your brothers. Oh, so tragic. Here's the major takeaway. You get to Genesis 50, verses 19 and 20. Listen carefully. Joseph responds, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? I'm not your judge," Joseph says. "You meant to do evil against me." You better believe it, they did. They wanted to do away with him. "You meant it for evil." And if we can expand on the thought here, I suffered for 13 years as a slave and a prisoner. But God meant it for good. God meant it for good. In order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. I saved you. I'm not going to destroy you now. That's what he's saying. God's the judge. You did wrong. But God used it for good. Isn't it wonderful to think about God's omniscience, his providence, and how he can work circumstances? That isn't it neat? Even when the Jews were going to kill the Christ and, you know, do away with him, they thought they were accomplishing their objective. When in fact, what are they doing? Helping to fulfill the will of God. Jesus, the Lamb of God, slain from the foundation of the world, Revelation 13:8. This passage here, where Joseph says that you meant evil, God could use it for good, friends, this gives me great encouragement. Because when circumstances fall into our laps, and we say, "How, God, how could you let this happen?" And it could be any number of things. How can you let it happen, God? Maybe one day you'll have an answer to that question, or maybe not. But it's okay if you don't have the answer. God is sovereign. God sees it all. He promises he'll work out in the end, in the final analysis, what's best for us. So Joseph, to my mind, is just another great example of this. And his response of faith, surely it's worthy of our emulation. I'll speak for myself. It'd be pretty hard for me not to become bitter if I wasted 13 years of my life for the envy and bitterness and hatred of other people. Joseph was a great man. Let's talk about Peter. He's going to be a little bit different of an example. Let's go to Matthew 14. I wanted to bring him up. He's a great example, although his example is of one of failure to some extent. We can relate to that, can't we? What's the takeaway for Peter? Trust God even when your life gets turbulent. And it does get turbulent for Peter. What do we see in Matthew 14? Well, right after John dies, of course, they're gonna try to get some time alone. We have the feeding of the 5,000 recorded. And then what? Of course, the people who were fed, they're going to seek Jesus again. They loved the miracles. Many of them weren't so concerned about the teaching, it would seem, but they loved the miracles and the food. But you get down to verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat, go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. Then what? Verse 24. But now the boat was in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. In the fourth watch of the night. So this is 3 a.m. In the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were scared. They were troubled. It's a ghost. It's a ghost. They were fearful. Jesus says, be a good cheer. Don't be afraid. It's I. So he's walking out to them. They're terrified. And Jesus calls out to them. And then what's going to happen? Peter's always happy to take the lead in talking, right? We mentioned that earlier this morning. That's a dangerous place to be. But Lord, if it's really you, command me to come out to you on the water. In other words, there was some doubt. I don't know why, but there was some doubt about Jesus' identity in their minds on this occasion. Maybe the visibility isn't quite as good as our picture up there. It's dark. They can't. What's out there? Is this real? Is it a ghost? If it's really you, tell me to walk out to you. Okay. Come on out. And Peter gets out of the boat. Can you imagine this? It's storming. It's wild. He's getting out of the boat. And he's able, not due to his own ability, but the water is supporting his weight miraculously. But when he saw, verse 30 here, when he saw the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. Beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. He was doing something incredible. And then when he realized what was really happening, he got scared. He starts to sink. And he cries out for Jesus to save him. And Jesus is there, catches him by the hand, and rebukes him with a question. Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? That's why he started sinking. He started to have some doubts. Friends, there's a lot of lessons that we could take from this. Sometimes in the Lord's work, we're doing great things. And then, maybe due to pride, maybe due to fear, maybe due to other circumstances, we get distracted from the main thing. We start majoring in minors and we focus on things that really don't matter, or we get sidetracked and adversity comes. Well, the Lord's always there. He's ready to save us. And Peter called out for him, and Jesus was right there. They both get in the boat, and then what? Immediate calm. You know, when I think about this, I do think about playing with, bathing the children in the bathtub. Of course, they're splashing water around. And you know, when that water is all stirred up, it doesn't just go calm immediately, does it? But here, they get in the boat and it's just all the energy in those waves. It's just, in my mind, these men are so impacted by the miracle. They knew this sea. They knew that's not what water's supposed to do. They know you're not supposed to walk on water. Unless it's frozen, right? They are in awe of this. They worshiped him. Truly, you are the Son of God. So Joseph is almost a perfect example. We know all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, Romans 3. But from what the text records about Joseph, man, he seems to be like a flawless Bible character. Type of Christ as well, no doubt. Peter, he had his problems. We know that, right? Besides the denials that were coming up soon in the ministry here, Peter, Jesus rebuked him, get behind me, Satan, on another occasion. But yet Peter, even with his ups and downs, he's a good example for us, right? God had a purpose for Peter. Peter had enough faith to get out of the boat. Would you get out of the boat? We're often quick to criticize Peter, and it's easy to do. Armchair quarterbacking, so to speak. Wow, yeah, he's always talking and he's saying things he can't follow through on hours later. And okay, fair enough. But he got out of the boat. But when his life got when he realized the turbulence and he realized, oh, this is rough, he started to sink. So when you find yourself in adversity, friends, keep looking at Jesus. Hebrews 12 would be a great extension of this. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. There's this great crowd of witnesses around us, Hebrews 11. People who have ran the race before, they're in the stands, as it were, cheering us on now. Lay aside every snare. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. Keep walking toward the author and finisher of our faith. Peter didn't do it perfectly, but he got back in the boat with the Lord, helped open up the kingdom to the Jews and the Gentiles in Acts 2 and Acts 10. Peter's a great example for us to follow. This might be my all-time favorite religious painting, if you will. I actually got a copy of it. It's displayed in a part of the Clinton Church building because I wanted others to see it. But the first time I asked somebody, "Do you know what's going on there?" And someone's like, "Is that guy surfing?" I'm like, no, he's not surfing. That sort of took a little bit out of the point I was going to try to make. It's not a surfer. It's a little bit ambiguous, I think, on purpose. But how I interpret this painting, there is someone standing on top of the surface of the water. And he's reaching his hand through the water down below. So from the perspective that we're looking at this, where are we? We're underwater. And we need someone there that knows how to deal with water, knows how to deal with people that are about to drown in their own wickedness. And he's got the hand there, and he's ready. Isn't that a great metaphor? Isn't Jesus' hand there for all of us, waiting for us to do what? To grab on. And us grabbing on by an obedient faith, it doesn't mean that we've earned anything, friends. If someone's out in the lake drowning and you throw them, you know, a life preserver, they're not going to get to the shore and brag about, "Well, you see what I did there? I held on to that thing the whole way in." A starving person who is begging for food, you have them a hamburger, you give them a hamburger, they're not going to brag about, "Hey, I ate that whole thing down and look at what I did." No, they're thankful because you were compassionate enough to help. And so it should be, you know, these discussions sometimes we have with our religious neighbors. Well, baptism, they'll say, it can't be a part of salvation because it's a work and you're earning your salvation, blah, blah. No, not at all. When we believe the message and we respond to it, we are merely underwater grabbing for the Lord's hand. You know, the answer of a good conscience, 1 Peter 3:21. And when we call on the name of the Lord, to me, what does it mean? And very broad, simple terms. We are, as we respond and obey the gospel, we are calling out for God just to forgive us, to cleanse our slate, to make us a new creation. God, we're not worthy. We are not worthy, but we are begging for your mercy. Me obeying this doesn't put me into your debt or anything like that. I know I am saved by your grace through my responsive faith. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. But isn't it a great plan? The plan that God has set forth. It's a wonderful plan. It's not that hard to trust God, though, when everything's going perfectly. We've touched on this a couple times over the last 24 hours. The real challenge is when things get bumpy. And we didn't say this morning, but I'll say it now. Satan was not completely wrong in his assessment of humans when he was talking to God the first time. When he said, in effect, "Of course Job is faithful to you. You've got this hedge of blessings around him. How could he not be faithful to you? Take that hedge away and watch what happens." Now, it didn't work with Job, but it's been my observation it does work for a lot of people. Our experiences with Ruby and the cancer, and I had people telling me early on, "Be careful. There's a super high preponderance of divorce in situations like this." I'm like, "Divorce? Yeah, all the focus on the sick child, and it interferes with every aspect of your life." No. Praise be to God. I've got a good wife, and we've got a good Lord, and we're going to keep on no matter what. Live or die, no matter what. But not everyone's made that choice. I've talked to at least a half a dozen people because of Ruby, that they'll come to me and they say things like, "I left the church because somebody died. I've set my faith aside because some tragic happened and I just couldn't see. I just couldn't understand how God could let this happen. It made me even doubt His existence and His love and His sovereignty. May it not be so, friends. We can't see the big picture. We have to trust. If God is big enough to create all this and set it in motion and sustain it, if He's big enough to see into our hearts and minds and know the very number of hairs on our head, if you're suffering and it's not due to your own sins, just trust Him. If it is due to your own sins, repent and come back to Him. We don't have to understand everything. What I've said is enough. It is enough. So, there's definitely a difference between making a mess of your own life and suffering as an innocent. And we're going to talk about that quite a bit tomorrow morning, actually, in Bible class. Where is God when the innocent are suffering? And we'll dive in even into some philosophy tomorrow morning, I hope. That will be helpful and connect it to Scripture as well. Thank you again for all your prayers for my daughter. There's a lot of problems with social media. There's a lot of people that choose not to be a part of social media, and I get it. There's a lot of negativity, a lot of poor influences, but for my family, having hundreds of people, even thousands of people that we don't even know, that will send us messages and send Ruby mail, is unbelievable. And even that was a test, you know? I remember Rebecca. Rebecca, where are you at? Can I talk about you for a minute? I'm going to do it anyway. especially during the first year when Ruby was really suffering a lot, she would get at least a couple pieces of mail every day, and sometimes she might get 6, 8, 10 pieces of mail. And a lot of it came from people we never even met or heard of. And it was really encouraging. And we always let Ruby open her mail. But a few months of that, older sister, more mail for Ruby again. We get it. Maybe we use different words. He got a job promotion again. He got to marry her. He got to take this trip. He got to do that. What about me, God? May our hearts not go there. Let's trust that He knows what's best. God will gift us abilities, resources, opportunities. And He wants us to be faithful. If you're a 5-talent servant, give Him 5 talents worth of service, friends. Don't look around at the brethren around you and say, well, I'm doing way more than them. You might be looking at 3-talent servants. God knows what all of us are capable of. Let's serve faithfully. Let's not compare one another to each other. Let's keep our eyes fixed on Jesus and do the best we can. And in the end, let's go home to live with Him in glory.